VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. says an evacuation mission of refugees on an Iraqi mountain is now less likely. Indonesia clamps down on support for the Islamic State group. Israel and Gaza fighters exchange fire. A ceasefire extension is announced. Help Age International reaches out to aid the elderly in Gaza.
They're very stressed and they're very traumatized. I mean, of course, many of them have lived through this a number of times over the years.
And the Panama Canal is turning 100. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The U.S. Defense Department says a military assessment team has determined a humanitarian crisis involving thousands of Yazidis fleeing Sunni extremists in northern Iraq is less grave than previously feared. VOA's Victor Beatty reports U.S. officials credit airdrops and airstrikes for making a costly and risky evacuation mission less likely.
Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby said a team of less than 20 U.S. military personnel, accompanied by officials of the U.S. Agency for International Development, conducted an assessment of the situation on the ground on Mount Sinjar early Wednesday. Kirby said the team did not engage in combat operations and all personnel returned safely to Erbil. Returning from Asia Wednesday, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said the team determined international airdrops, U.S. airstrikes on Islamic State targets, and efforts by the Kurdish Peshmerga fighters allowed thousands of Yazidis trapped on the mountain to evacuate.
Not only were there fewer people up there, but they were in relatively good condition, and the people up there credited our efforts with the water and the food, and also buying space and time with those airstrikes against ISIL. So that's good news.
Hagel said as a result, a rescue mission that had been planned appears less likely. Pentagon spokesman Kirby said airdrops of food and water would continue. U.S. Central Command said a seventh such airdrop was conducted late Wednesday. White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes Wednesday said the U.S. had also conducted seven airstrikes against IS targets, but added a lasting solution to get the refugees to a safe space may still be needed.
We don't believe it's sustainable to just have permanent airdrops to this population on the mountain. Some of them have been able to escape. But again, we want to get options in place to move them to a safer place. There are a range of ways for doing that. Again, we're going to be cooperating with Kurdish forces who are also operating the region, other international partners.
He insisted that does not involve U.S. troops reentering a combat role in Iraq. RAND Corporation senior international policy analyst and retired Marine intelligence officer Ben Conable says a rescue operation in the region would be complicated to carry out.
There's no point in acting before really thinking through what the consequences are and what the costs would be. Picking people up and moving them in perhaps into the secured Kurdish areas sounds like a logical and safe thing to do, but it also would entail a lot of activity in the Kurdish areas. It would be a much more significant displacement for the Yazidis, and it might even have some political consequences.
Attacks by Sunni militants since June have displaced thousands of minority Iraqi Christians and Yazidis as IS expands its self-declared caliphate in parts of Iraq and Syria. Amid reports, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is resisting calls to make way for Prime Minister-designate Haider al-Abadi in Baghdad. Rhodes said all Iraqi leaders should respect the peaceful political transition now underway.
There's a new president. There's a new speaker of parliament. And the Shia alliance of different political blocs has put forward Dr. Abadi as a candidate for prime minister. And now the president has asked him to form a government. So in our view, he is clearly the prime minister designate in Iraq. This process now needs to go forward for him to put together a government and submit it to parliament. But that is the process in place that all Iraqis have to respect. And frankly, any efforts to derail that process, any efforts to use violence instead of working peacefully through the political process would be rejected not just by the United States, but by Iraqis themselves, by the international community.
Rhodes said there is an enormous opportunity with a new prime minister in place to get a unity government that all Iraq's different factions can support and then turn the focus to where it needs to be, which is combating the threat from IS. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
As the jihadist insurgency in Syria and Iraq intensifies, so too does its appeal to hardline Islamists in the world's largest Muslim-majority nation. As Kate Lamb reports from Jakarta, the Indonesian government has moved swiftly to crack down on the possibility of a revived terrorist threat.
on the streets of Jakarta and across pockets of Java. Small groups of hardline extremists have openly pledged their allegiance to the Islamic State extremist group. Thousands more have mimicked their cries on social networking sites. And from maximum security prison, hardliner preacher Abu Bakr Bashir has also pledged an oath to the newly declared Islamic Caliphate, photos of which have circulated online. The Indonesian government has moved to swiftly crack down on the developments, earlier this month officially banning the group and the spread of its teachings. The government says the hardline group, formerly known as the Islamic State in Syria and the Levant, contradicts Indonesia's pluralist state ideology, Pancasila, and that it will block websites displaying its content. Sri Yunanto from Indonesia's National Counterterrorism Agency told a panel discussion on Wednesday that it is stepping up efforts to curb the threat of Indonesian fighters returning from Syria, what he described as jihadi alumni.
We have to be prepared when the issue of ISIS in the Middle is over and then they come back into Indonesia. We have experience with the issue of Afghan fighters, Moro fighters. We don't want that the ISIS graduate, if I may say, ISIS alumni in Indonesia and Iran will be like them.
Key individuals behind major terrorist attacks in Indonesia, such as the 2002 Bali bombings, received direct training with MILF, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front in the Philippines, and in Afghanistan in the late 80s and early 90s. Over the past decade, Indonesia has successfully dismantled hardline groups, such as Jamaah Islamiyah, and most senior hardliners have either been killed or incarcerated. For would-be Indonesian jihadis, the Syrian conflict represents an appealing training ground, one where they can gain weapons and bomb-making skills and develop contacts with a well-funded terrorist group. Taufik Andri, the executive director of the Institute of International Peacebuilding, says that in Indonesia's current terrorism landscape, it is the splinter or freelance jihadists that pose the biggest threat.
Mostly, the Indonesian jihadis are driven by the individual motivation, not necessarily by groups or leaders' comment. They got enough information from the internet, from the Facebook and Twitter, and that's enough for them to decide. Freelance jihadi, individuals, it is just a matter of money.
The government believes that up to 30 Indonesians have joined the Islamic State in Syria, but analysts say the figure could reach 200. Porous borders and poor coordination between agencies and ministries has allowed some individuals to buy tickets to Turkey and then cross the border into Syria undetected. Even though the numbers of Indonesian fighters joining the conflict in Syria are small, Todd Elliott, a Jakarta-based terrorism analyst from Concord Consulting, says returned jihadis pose a significant security threat in the long term.
I don't think there's an immediate threat of jihadists returning and immediately using any skills they had to launch a terrorist attack. But the fact that they have these skills and they're available and they can pass it on to younger jihadists and other groups, that's where the risk lies.
Indonesian authorities have threatened to revoke the citizenship of individuals who continue to support the Islamic State and say they will better monitor its citizens travelling to the Middle East in the near future. For VOA News, this is Kate Lamb, Jakarta.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says resolving competing territorial claims in the South China Sea is about respecting international law and not about rival claimants trying to intimidate each other. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports that Secretary Kerry spoke in Hawaii at the end of a week-long trip to Asia.
Secretary Kerry says disputed mineral and fishing rights in the South China Sea underlie more fundamental legal questions of sovereignty and rights of free passage.
You know, they're really about more than claims to islands and reefs and rocks and the economic interests that flow from them. They're about whether might makes right, or whether global rules and norms and rule of law and international law will prevail.
This is one of the world's busiest shipping lanes, where China's Coast Guard already has clashed with vessels from both Vietnam and the Philippines. Indonesia, Brunei, Malaysia, and Taiwan also have competing claims in the South China Sea, where Kerry says a constructive U.S.-China relationship will contribute to stability.
President Obama has made it clear that the United States welcomes the rise of a peaceful, prosperous, and stable China, one that plays a responsible role in Asia and the world, and supports rules and norms on economic and security issues.
Kerry says Washington wants to avoid the trap of strategic rivalry with China. But China over the weekend helped undercut U.S. efforts to freeze provocative actions in the South China Sea, further eroding Washington's so-called pivot of diplomatic and military resources, says American Enterprise Institute analyst Michael Oslin.
Look at the way that the waterscape in Asia has changed. Look at China's increasing coercion, bordering on aggression right now. You're not doing anything about that. And yet, at every turn, at every occasion, you remind us about how important the pivot is to you. I just think people don't know what to make of it.
With the Philippines and Vietnam looking to Washington for help, American University professor Hilary Mann Leverett says China is pushing U.S. allies to the point where Beijing believes Washington will show the weakness of its Asia policy by failing to come to their aid.
It's a really focused, determined strategy based on assumptions that the United States is not really going to put its military wherewithal into the South China Sea to fight China over issues that it doesn't really care about.
A perception that she says hurts Washington at a time when Beijing and Moscow see a greater common cause.
The concern about U.S. policy has been pushing Russia and China together now for a few years, particularly since the start of the Arab Awakening over Libya, over Syria. We've been seeing them push coming together more and more, especially on hydrocarbon issues.
Kerry says the Obama administration is working to raise trade and investment standards in Asia because he says national interests are advanced not just by troops or by diplomats, but by entrepreneurs and by good corporate citizens. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Israel says it has carried out airstrikes in the Gaza Strip in response to Palestinian rocket fire. The hostilities came as a five-day extension of a temporary ceasefire was announced in Egypt. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli military said it staged airstrikes against Palestinian militant targets in Gaza after at least eight rockets were fired into Israel. A statement said the rocket attacks began 2 hours before a three-day ceasefire expired. An official of Hamas, which controls Gaza, said its forces had not staged any such attacks and accused Israel of violating the ceasefire. The flare-up of violence came as Palestinian negotiator Azam Ahmed announced a five-day extension of the truce following 3 days of talks in Cairo. He said in the final moments it was agreed to extend the ceasefire for 5 more days. He added the ceasefire would begin at midnight Wednesday night and continue until Monday. He said Palestinian and Israeli negotiators had agreed on some points, but that some issues remained to be resolved. There was no comment from Israel. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon earlier had told Israeli armed forces to be prepared for a possible resumption of hostilities. He warned that he did not know if there would be a new ceasefire agreement and said if shooting erupted, Israeli forces would return fire and resume operations. During the 5 weeks of conflict, more than 1,900 Palestinians were killed, mostly civilians, and some 9,000 others were wounded. 64 Israeli soldiers were killed, along with 3 civilians. Hamas said it would accept a truce if Israel ended its 7-year-old blockade of Gaza. Israel says Gaza must be demilitarized. Each side reportedly had agreed on measures to facilitate the movement of goods and people across the Gaza border, but they appeared to be still far apart on a Palestinian demand that an airport and seaport be allowed in the enclave and Israel's demand that Palestinian fighters disarm. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
HelpAge International, an organization aimed at helping the elderly, has stationed a program manager in Gaza. We asked Alex Bush, head of operations for HelpAge, about his project there.
Well, we set out with our partners in the UK and elsewhere to try to provide some relief to a lot of older people who've been badly affected in Gaza, lost homes, displaced into other people's homes or into UN schools, suffering a great deal of trauma. So we've just begun to try to address some of those issues.
About how many people are we talking about here?
Well, in Gaza, we're talking around 110,000 older people. There's about 350,000 people who've been displaced by what's gone on in the last few weeks. So about 6% of those are older people.
Specifically, what do these people need?
Well, at the moment, a lot of them are in the various schools that have been set up as sort of temporary camps and I think are broadly being rather well looked after. But we've seen a lot of people who've taken in family members. I was out with a group yesterday visiting an old lady who's 85, bedridden. A family of eight had taken in 16 extra family members for the last few weeks. So you can imagine how difficult it is. And she just needs a bit of support, a bit of counseling. She needs hygiene kits. That's the main thing she needs at the moment. Hopefully, her family are going to be able to go home fairly soon.
What is the attitude of the older people that you're speaking to there?
Well, they're very stressed and they're very traumatized. I mean, of course, many of them have lived through this a number of times over the years. I think older people tend to be extremely reluctant to leave their houses. As I said, over 300,000 people have actually moved out of their houses. We know some older people have been left behind, and that's placed them at considerable risk.
What is the feeling about the international community? Are they bitter because the international community hasn't done more for them?
No, I don't get that sense at all. I think people are very grateful for what's being done. We're obviously seeing a lot of demand. It's been, as you know, very difficult to work until the last 3 days. I wasn't able to get into Gaza till 3 days ago. So we are seeing a lot of demand, but we're not seeing bitterness at all.
What about in the long term?
The long term is a really difficult question, Susan. The level of destruction in some parts of Gaza is immense, and just sort of by observation, it's difficult to see how people will be able to go back into many of those homes. On the other hand, there are homes that are only sort of partially damaged, broken windows, broken doors. I think there'll be quite a substantial effort at reconstruction kicking into gear pretty soon.
Perhaps you could describe for us in your own words what you have seen.
It's a very mixed picture. There are corners of Gaza City where you don't see a great deal of damage, but hidden away in those corners, you've got an awful lot of people living in very cramped spaces. And we saw a group who'd come in from one of the very damaged areas looking for somewhere to stay, and a family of 11, three generations of them, had basically rented a storeroom in Gaza City and were eking out a living in there. And then as you go out towards the border where the fighting was more intense, you see a lot of real devastation, whole streets completely destroyed, obviously being in severe fires. And very few people out there at the moment because people are still not certain whether they can go home.
Well, thank you very much for your insight, and please be careful.
Thank you, Susan.
Alex Bush, head of operations for HelpAge International, speaking with us from Gaza.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Germany is urging its citizens to leave Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia due to the Ebola outbreak in the West African nations. The foreign ministry announced the government directive on Wednesday, but said the appeal for nationals to leave did not apply to medical workers or diplomatic staff. Experimental drugs used to fight the Ebola outbreak arrived Wednesday in Liberia as the effects of the deadly virus continue to spread. The World Health Organization says 1,069 people have died and nearly 2,000 cases of Ebola have been reported. In just 2 days this week, there were 120 new confirmed cases and 56 fatalities. The U.S.-produced drug, not yet tested in humans, will be used to treat two doctors in Liberia. Meantime, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan on Wednesday reassured citizens of his government's commitment towards containing the spread of Ebola, despite the country recording its third death. Nigeria's information minister, Laburan Maku, spoke about the number of Ebola cases.
The number of people that have been traced is 198. Now, out of this number, 177 are in Lagos, and they are being traced. Some are in quarantine. Some are being monitored by health specialists. Their movements, you know, being monitored, and they are under directive from the Minister of Health.
During an emergency meeting with state governors and health officials Wednesday, President Jonathan emphasized the need for all to unite in overcoming the disease. The Panama Canal turns 100 this week. Officially opened in 1914, the 77-kilometer channel joins the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans at the Isthmus of Panama. It made the world smaller, creating a shortcut for cargo ships. But 100 years later, the canal is straining from the demands of expanding global trade. And Mil Arcega reports for VOA Television, it may also be facing some serious competition over the next 100 years.
Taking over 30 years to build, tens of thousands of workers, and more than 27 million kilograms of dynamite, it's considered one of the biggest engineering feats of the 20th century. University of Maryland professor Julie Green is author of the book, The Canal Builders.
The Panama Canal is one of those phenomenal moments in history, a terrific example of engineering and technological strength of the United States, and really the coming of age of the United States as a global power.
But the work exacted a heavy toll. By the time the first ship crossed the canal, nearly 26,000 workers had died, some from accidents, many from malaria. But it also changed international commerce forever, especially in the U.S., says George Washington University professor Noel Moore on Skype.
It's because it enabled, for the first time, oil from California and lumber from the Pacific Northwest, but it was really the Californian oil that was driving the boat.
Today, more than 4% of the world's commerce passes through the canal, some 14,000 ships per year. But the canal's locks are now too small for much of the world's container fleet and the largest oil tankers. Transportation expert Rodney McFadden says bigger ships can be more efficient and more profitable.
They carry more cargo for about the same amount of money per mile. They are much easier on the environment, and they increase trade.
A Hong Kong company is backing a $40 billion plan to dig an alternate route through Nicaragua. If successful, it could pose a serious challenge to the canal. But critics say the project is redundant and impractical, especially when the Panama Canal is in the midst of a $5 billion expansion. Once complete, the new locks will accommodate ships the length of the Empire State Building and as wide as three basketball courts. Autodesk, the New Hampshire-based company that created the software for the project, is thrilled. Not only has the expansion created over 250,000 jobs, once finished, it will create thousands more around the world, says Autodesk spokesman Paul Sullivan on Skype.
The ripple effect here is interesting because once this canal is completed and these ships are able to transit the canal, you're going to see a lot more cities around the world competing for improving their ports so they can support those larger ships.
Of the approximately 160 ports in the U.S., only about 15 can accommodate the larger supertankers that will pass through the expanded canal. By early 2016, experts say this grand canal will be able to handle 97% of the world's container ships, doubling the canal's capacity and ensuring that it remains a marvel of engineering 100 years from now. Mil Arcega, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On August 14, 1848, the U.S. territory of Oregon was organized by an act of Congress. On this day in 1880, Cologne Cathedral, one of the best-known architectural achievements in Germany, was completed. Its spires reached a height of 157 meters, at the time the tallest structure in the world. It took over 600 years to complete. In 1900, an international force of European, American, and Japanese troops broke a Chinese nationalist siege of Peking's diplomatic quarter, effectively ending what was called the Boxer Rebellion, an anti-Western uprising. In 1935, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. Social Security is a government-sponsored retirement supplement program.
This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 millions of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health.
Social Security has since expanded its coverage to benefit disabled people. In 1941, even before America's entry into World War II, President Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill issued a joint declaration known as the Atlantic Charter. It was a statement of policy outlining Allied goals for a post-Nazi Europe. On this day in 1945, President Harry Truman announced that Japan had agreed to Allied terms of surrender, thus ending World War II. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Much of the history of the 21st century is going to be written right here in Asia, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said at the U.S.-ASEAN ministerial meeting recently held in Burma. ASEAN is at the center of the Asia-Pacific region's multilateral architecture, and it plays a critical role in promoting both peace, prosperity, and also a regional integration throughout Asia. The United States remains deeply committed to engaging the Asia-Pacific region. ASEAN, in our judgment, is fundamental to our being able to uphold a rules-based system in the Asia-Pacific and ensuring that all countries, big and small, have a say in how we work together, Secretary Kerry said. We're strengthening our people-to-people ties through President Barack Obama's Young Southeast Asian Leaders Initiative, which provides critical leadership in development and networking in ASEAN. We're supporting the formation of the ASEAN Economic Community in 2015, which will sustain the prosperity of the ASEAN region. We're also working closely together to protect the environment. We recognize the tremendous economic dynamism of this region and its people, he continued. We also recognize our shared prosperity demands a renewed commitment to sustainable economic growth. That is why we're focused not only on growing our countries and making them stronger, but on also growing fair and just societies, particularly countries with clean air, clean water, and shared river resources for all Southeast Asian nations. The United States and ASEAN have a common responsibility in maintaining peace and stability on the high seas and to ensure the maritime security that is critical to global trade. Secretary Kerry stressed the importance of managing tensions in the South China Sea on the basis of international law. This means voluntarily agreeing to refrain from actions that would complicate or escalate disputes. It's no understatement that what happens here matters not just to this region and to the United States, Secretary Kerry said. It matters to everybody in the world to see a Southeast Asia that continues to grow based on rules-based international law.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.